This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room where you, me and the top experts come together to understand the great issues of the day. Inside this week's 28 Minutes, there have been a number of high-profile attacks recently against infrastructure and hospitals, with cyber criminals turning ransomware into a lucrative business. So what exactly is ransomware, and can we defeat it? You're the first into the office. Maybe you work for a large company or perhaps a hospital. You log in, and up comes a message, possibly illustrated with a skull and crossbones, informing you that your computers are now useless, everything on them is inaccessible, and they're going to stay that way until you pay a fee. What you're experiencing is a ransomware attack. It happened recently to the Irish Health Service and to an important oil pipeline in America. So-called ransomware attacks are becoming more frequent and more expensive to deal with. So what exactly is ransomware, and can we defeat it? Step into the briefing room and let's find out. First, I want to know exactly what a ransomware attack is, how it's conducted, and what the victim experiences. Joining me in the briefing room is Emily Taylor, the CEO of the cyber intelligence consultancy Oxford Information Labs and editor of Chatham House's Journal of Cyber Policy. Emily Taylor, let's start with the basics. What is a ransomware attack?
Well, ransomware is a type of malware which encrypts a victim's files. So that means it's really, in simple terms, a form of extortion. What happens is you are denied access to your files, either because their names have been changed or, more commonly now, because they've been locked away, they've been encrypted so that you can't get at them, and they can only be accessed by you again if the attacker gives you a key to decrypt them, to open them up again. Another thing that can happen is that the attacker can threaten to publish those files. And that actually happened to a New York law firm last year that was representing a variety of celebrity clients like Lady Gaga. And the attackers ended up publishing 2.4 gigabytes of Lady Gaga's legal documents. And so there are various hazards. The first is just not being able to function because all of your files are locked away. And then there's another aspect, which is that the attackers might threaten or might actually publish those files if you don't pay the ransom. And that's what we call double extortion.
How do the criminals get into the systems they're targeting?
The exploit, the way in, can come through a variety of methods. And often these are quite familiar now, a phishing attack where somebody gets an email that looks like it's genuine and they click on a link, they download a document, and in doing so, they're actually infecting their system. Another type of way in, which we saw in the Atlanta attack a couple of years ago, an attack against an entire city, was that the attackers use poorly secured websites and just sort of guess a password and get into systems as a result. So there are a variety of ways in, as there are for any cyber attack. And really what makes it a ransomware attack is what is carried in as part of that initial exploit.
Now, in my introduction, I've imagined somebody coming into an office early in the morning, logging in, and then getting a message on a computer screen. Is that usually the first sign that something has happened?
Yes, it is. And it can be really devastating and cause immense panic. Speaking to people who've gone through it, they say the most disorientating thing is that you just don't know anything anymore, you know, because all of your access to everything is blocked off. And that can be very disorientating, especially when you are running critical infrastructure, as we saw very recently with the Colonial Pipeline, a ransomware attack, or the entire health service of a country, as we saw with Ireland just a couple of weeks ago. And so, you know, when your actual job is very urgent and lots of people are relying on you, having this kind of attack can cause panic and you just want to get started and restarted as quickly as possible. So, of course, you're going to have a very strong motivation to pay the ransom.
Can you just remind us briefly what happened in the Colonial Pipeline and Ireland attacks?
The Colonial Pipeline actually serves oil and gas to the east coast of America. And earlier this month, it was hit by a ransomware attack. And as a result, they shut off their operational systems as an abundance of caution. But what you can see immediately is that where you have an attack on critical infrastructure, the impact on people's lives is immediate and quite profound. In Ireland, we saw that the entire health service was affected by a ransomware attack. And effectively, those systems had to shut down and people had to go back to manual processes.
I've imagined that the moment that you know you are attacked is when you get the message on the screen. Has the attack actually started before that moment?
It depends. On some estimates, it can be as little as 3 seconds between the attack taking place, the exploit being successful, and the encryption starting to take place. So just as you're thinking, oh, why did I click that link? It's already started. On other types of ransomware attacks, we've seen that the perpetrators have gone in and sort of lurked on the system, moving laterally through the network, figuring out where the most valuable files are stored and biding their time before actually triggering the encryption.
Now, how do the criminals get paid?
A variety of mechanisms, but the most commonly used at the moment is that they will ask to be paid in a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin because it gives a level of anonymity for the perpetrators.
How do you pay in a cryptocurrency? Because most companies, and let's say the Irish Health Service, is very unlikely to have access to significant amounts of Bitcoin.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And we've seen some extraordinary developments over the last couple of months. For example, the criminal gangs give handy guides to their victims on how to actually get the payment done. Because, you know, Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is not that familiar to many people. So they provide these helpful guides in some cases.
Emily Taylor. That's the what, now the how big. What are the real consequences of these attacks and just how much are they on the increase? Joining me in the briefing room is Sadie Creese, the Professor of Cybersecurity at Oxford University. Sadie Creese, as far as we can tell, is the problem of ransomware growing?
Yes, certainly it's growing. All the indications are there. We can't know for sure just how big a problem this is because, of course, we only know what we have seen. We don't know that it's all been reported. The ones that we will be hearing about are the ones that are newsworthy, they're significantly large, that they're creating a lot of disruption. And of course, in recent years, we've seen a move away from simply trying to extort money by denying someone access to their data to a threat of releasing that data if they don't pay. So that's additional pressure. And we're also seeing that that threat's getting enacted. And that, of course, causes us to see more evidence because this data is being released, sometimes being sold. Sometimes the ability to extort in that way is being sold on as well. And that's, if you like, a new characteristic in recent years, because these attacks have been going on for at least 20 years, if not longer.
So some of the attackers sell on the vulnerabilities into the system to somebody else to exploit.
There will be examples where they've actually sold on the ability to offer the decryption function. So effectively sold on the encrypted data and the key to other criminals and let them have a go at trying to extort more ransom for access to it. They can divide that up, they can sell it on to multiple parties. And you can imagine that this has gone beyond simply encrypting someone's database that they may need access to something that is effectively sabotage of systems. So in recent attacks, we've seen people having to stop doing business, whatever that might be, because they need to try and contain the threat. And whatever it is that's been disabled within their systems is actually quite crucial and might sit underneath an awful lot of operations.
Now, let's look at who is more at risk than others. I mean, in the first instance, are there some parts of the world where this is more likely to happen than others?
Yeah, certainly when it comes to extortion attacks like ransomware, those that are going to have the ability to pay are going to be more at risk. However, about around 10 years ago, we saw an upsurge in ransomware attacks on medium-sized enterprises where the ransom demands were actually lower and the criminals were doing this at a higher volume. So they still made the same amount of money, but they did it by attacking more organisations. You might think that parts of the world that were better at protecting themselves and therefore would have less attack surface, less vulnerability that could be exploited, you might say we expect them to suffer less in the face of this kind of attack. But that's simply not true. We're seeing an awful lot of reports of ransomware attacks against organisations in the US and the UK, and yet the US and the UK are leading nations when it comes to cybersecurity and defending themselves. But there's a number of factors that put you at risk. One of them is there have to be threats that are motivated to attack you and have the capability to attack you. And you need to be mindful that over the years, the technical ability to conduct these attacks has effectively been de-skilled. The tools are shared openly on the dark web. These organisations need to be vulnerable. Well, it's incredibly difficult to fully defend any organisation, so the chances are you'll find ways in. And then, of course, there needs to be some kind of harm. There needs to be a reason why somebody would be willing to pay the ransom to avoid that harm. And that perhaps in some way goes to explain why we're seeing such an upsurge in recent years. It's not just that we continue to be vulnerable. It's not just that there are growing ecosystem of threat actors who are able to conduct the attacks because they're getting easier to deploy, but it's also because we have a growing dependence on these kinds of digital infrastructures, which means the losses or the harms that we can face are going up. And that means we might be prepared to pay to avoid some of them.
Are the criminals evolving new techniques?
There's always an evolution of cyber weaponry, of course there is, because as we see techniques used against us, then we can develop our defences to counter them. But we also need to remember that, therefore, there's always a motivation to not expose your new techniques unless you really have to, because somebody can learn how to counter and defend against them. So oftentimes, what we're really seeing is small evolutions, small tweaks on old tool sets that being changed in such a way that they can get past some of our defences, get into the systems, and then run whatever kind of exploits they need to run in order to encrypt the data or sabotage the system in some way.
Can we talk a little bit about what the bigger effects for ordinary citizens can be from these types of attacks?
If you're unlucky enough to be a customer of one of these organisations for something that you do care about that would cause you some difficulty, so if your bank had to shut down its activities for a whole day, if you had a relative in a hospital that could no longer receive the operation they urgently needed because that part of the hospital systems had to be shut down, if your lights go out for a number of days because the energy's shut down in that part of the world, then you will start feeling some pain, some harm from it. So yes, we do all need to care, even though it's not currently the case for the vast majority of us that we would ever actually have our personal systems targeted and be asked for a ransom.
Sadie Creese. Now onto the who, as in who is doing it. With me in the briefing room is Jeff White, an investigative journalist, author, and currently the co-presenter of the BBC's podcast series about major cyber attacks, The Lazarus Heist. Jeff White, we've heard about what ransomware attacks are, who's likely to be attacked. Now let's talk about who the people are who are behind these attacks. What can we say about them?
What's interesting is ransomware's a development on earlier forms of cybercrime. So after the sort of fall of the Soviet Union, you had a great deal of fraud activity, particularly cyber fraud activity, and that morphed into bank hacking stuff. So as online banking took off, they started raiding people's online bank accounts. And the gangs who are behind that are the gangs that have now morphed into doing ransomware. The problem with hacking into people's bank accounts is, yes, you can hack a bank account if you're very good at it, you can transfer the money, but you've got to transfer it to another bank account, and that's potentially going to leave a trail for investigators to trace. The wondrous thing about ransomware and about the invention of the virtual currency Bitcoin is it's given these ransomware attackers the ability to bypass the banking system completely. So Bitcoin, combined with this evolution of cybercrime into ransomware, has really created a massive cash cow for the gangs who were doing that bank hacking stuff. Most security researchers you talk to will say, look, the concentration of this stuff has been in the Russian Federation. Russia had a very deep interest in science and technology. In fact, half of Russian graduates in the 1990s in Russian universities were science and technology students. You know, they came out of those courses very skilled, very bright, into an economy that was collapsing, and they couldn't, a lot of them, get the jobs that they wanted or that they needed. And so that sort of led to this emergence of credit card fraud and cybercrime. That sort of grew up in the Russian Federation. However, what we've now got is a situation where the people who create this ransomware basically make it available for free on a sort of franchise basis and say, look, if you want to download this ransomware and spread it, feel free, go ahead. We'll take a cut of the profits you make. So whilst the centre of gravity, you might say, is probably still in the Russian Federation, the actual operators and the users of this ransomware are increasingly distributed worldwide. This is one of the big advancements in cybercrime, and also has made it obviously much harder to attribute these attacks. I mean, the recent Colonial Pipeline attack was fascinating in that, you know, you could identify, I think, the ransomware that was used to attack that particular company. But when people got in touch with that ransomware maker, those virus writers, they said, well, we didn't choose to pick Colonial Pipeline and hack them. That was the people who were using our ransomware themselves, our affiliates, as they call them, the trade. It's a really advanced system, this.
Am I to think about lone hackers in bedrooms, or am I to think about essentially a mafia group that may have been doing one thing has now moved into this?
Yes, cybercrime has become a very, very organised industry. You know, these are professional guys, and it is still mostly guys doing this. They clock in and out. It's a Monday to Friday, 9-to-5 job. So this idea of, you know, it's hoodies and hackers and teenagers in their bedrooms, you know, having a pop, that's very, very far from the truth. Although, in the current world we've got with ransomware, there's no reason why one of those sort of bedroom-based hackers couldn't try and get hold of some of this ransomware as an affiliate and become part of the network of people spreading it round in exchange for a cut of the profits.
Is there competition between criminal groups? I mean, traditionally what's happened is that somebody said, I want a bit of that and I don't want you to have a bit of that. And there is a kind of degree of inter-criminal activity.
Yes, there's been a long history of cyber criminals hacking each other and trying to take each other's operations down. However, there's also a huge amount of collaboration, it seems, among cybercrime gangs. So you'll have somebody who's written the ransomware, They want to send it out via email, but they don't have a bunch of email addresses to send it to. So one criminal gang will work with another criminal gang to say, well, look, here's the ransomware. You send it out to the email addresses that you've got on your lists, and we'll sort of split the profits in the end. So it's a febrile community that interacts and collaborates as much as it's in conflict.
Now, what about the association of the, let's say, just the money gain from these attacks with other forms of criminal activity?
Well, yeah, what's interesting is this idea that, you know, cybercrime sort of stands divorced and stands separate to other forms of crime. That's not the case. There is a heavy end interface between cybercrime and traditional crime. So yes, you can use virtual currencies like Bitcoin to move your money around the world, but at some stage, you're going to need to get that money in cash so you can buy your yacht or your Lamborghini or your gin palace. You're going to have to convert it into cash. And at that stage, you're going to need people to go to the cash point and withdraw it. And that relies on people trafficking and money muling. You are utilizing people. Often you are extorting them or bribing them or in some other way coercing them to take part in this. So don't think for a second that cybercrime is a sort of clean way of doing crime.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of this is based in the Russian Republic. Is that because the government tolerates it, or because the government there actually possibly uses some of it for its own purposes, has relationships with it?
There have been some fairly clear indications, I think, that the Russian government has acquiesced in this. So there's one very famous computer hacker video that shows Vladimir Putin pinning medals onto hackers' chests as though they're sort of doing a service for the Russian Federation. The other thing is Russia, and it has to be said other governments as well, has been accused of actually using ransomware itself as an offensive weapon. So there was a ransomware strain called NotPetya, which broke out back in 2017, started in Ukraine. And for a lot of people, that was an indication that this was an attempt by the Russian government to bring its adversary down in a sort of non-military, but equally damaging and disruptive way. And so that being attributed by some to the Russian Federation gives an indication of the fact that governments, including Russia, are potentially prepared to use these ransomware tools not to make money, but just to disrupt and destroy their adversary's computer infrastructure.
Is there any case of governments piggybacking on the back of malware access gained by criminals?
Yes, we have seen indications of that. Some researchers have discovered infections that they can say are organized crime gang type infection. What they've then seen is another player coming into that, North Korea in this case, is the accusation, using those cyber criminal gangs' tools, but using them for intelligence gathering operations, or in North Korea's case, often money making operations. So we are starting to see, and this is one of the most worrying things, a kind of confluence between organized cybercrime gangs and nation states. And the reason that's worrying is organized cybercrime gangs have the network, they have the drive, they have the experience. Governments have the time and the resources to throw into this. And if you put those two things together, that's a really dangerous combination, I think.
Jeff White on who the perpetrators are. Finally, what to do about it. Susan Landau is Professor of Cybersecurity and Policy at Tufts University in the United States. Susan Landau, early in the programme, we've heard how this operates, who does it, and how much it's grown. So my question to you first is, whose job do you think it is to stop it?
Well, we would think that it would be law enforcement and national security, especially if the attacks are coming from abroad. But in fact, the people most in a position to stop it are the people whose systems are attacked. And what they need to do is institute good security, have backups. But this is harder than it would seem. You, of course, want to have what we call two-factor authentication, not just a password, but some device that provides information at the moment. You also want to separate out the public-facing parts of your systems, the IT systems, from the operational parts of your systems, with very strong security between the two, so that nobody who somehow breaks into your corporate IT system or your billing IT system can get to the operational part of your system is really crucial.
How well set up do you think such institutions are at the moment?
Many of them have not been. The Ukraine power grid was a real wake-up call. In the United States, we have four major power grids, and everybody said for a long time, well, yes, somebody attacking couldn't shut them all down at once. And what we saw in December 2015 in Ukraine was that three different grids were shut down within a half hour of one another. That was a wake-up call within the United States and other parts of the world as well, to build resiliency into the system. These days in cybersecurity, we don't talk about being secure because we describe systems as either you know that somebody is in your system or you don't yet know it, but they're there. Huh. And so we talk about the systems being resilient instead. That is, you're still able to do the most fundamental part of your job, even though somebody is inside your system attempting to attack it. The attacker only has to find one way in, whereas the defenders have to protect everything. And it's extremely complicated with these very large, complex software and hardware systems. So the key word now is resilience rather than security.
Now, I know it's a very broad generalization, but how far away are institutions in general, including large ones, from developing that resilience?
Quite far. Over the last 30 years, 40 years, we digitized society, at least in certain parts of the world, without really building the security and the resilience in. And in many cases, because we didn't see an immediate impact on the bottom line. But the attacks have gotten more severe and odder too. Ransomware coming from a government like North Korea is not something anybody anticipated. The information warfare attacks that Europe and the United States has seen from Russia are not things we anticipated 8 years ago. And so we're playing catch up even while we're keeping the power grid going and the oil pipeline going and so on and so forth. And that's hard.
Now, of course, talking about the attacks coming from abroad, is the international regime strong enough to help prevent some of this?
Here it's a very complicated situation. We have not had very much in the way of international agreements, at least on the part of the United States, and that's partially because spying, doing exploits within a system, has been useful, not only for the U.S. government and other countries to learn what their adversaries are doing, but sometimes, of course, we know spying then leads us to understand motivations on the other side and maybe dial things down rather than dial things up as we understand, no, there isn't something nefarious or as nefarious as we thought.
Talking about ransomware attacks specifically, what we've heard is that a large proportion of them actually get paid. We've had this discussion with regard to hostage taking in the past, and one of the things that some governments have said is, firstly, you should make reporting hostages being taken mandatory and paying ransoms effectively impossible. Can't we do the same with regard to ransomware attacks?
Well, that's in fact what the US government recommends and insists upon, but doesn't actually then prosecute somebody who does pay the ransom. It's long-term a bad idea to do because it encourages the type of crime. But the governments so far have not enforced any regulations against paying the ransom. And it's worth noting that something like 25-29% of those paying the ransom never get their data back.
Can we make it mandatory, however, to actually report the ransomware attacks?
We can legally make it a requirement. But unless you have a way of actually enforcing, it's not clear that that will be effective. You also have to think, if you're a person in government and you say to somebody like Colonial Pipeline, we will not let you pay that ransom, and then it turns out they can't get their systems running for 3 weeks or 4 weeks and there are tremendous gas shortages, I wouldn't want to be the government official who gets accused of causing all those gas shortages. So it's a complicated dance.
Can I just ask you to push forward a bit? Do you think we'll look back on this in a decade as a necessary chapter in learning how to defend ourselves, a kind of situation you had to go through, or actually as the beginning of a catastrophe that we just couldn't control?
Well, I certainly hope the former, not the latter. If I look at the United States and I compare it with traveling around the world, I see delayed expenditure on infrastructure all over, whether you talk about LaGuardia Airport as looking a little bit like a third world country airport, or other efforts not built in. I think that there's been delayed expenditure on infrastructure, and that includes here. The current U.S. presidential administration really does want to invest in infrastructure, and that would mean not only roads and highways, but also types of social infrastructure. And clearly there's attention to cyber at a serious level. I would expect there to be in other parts of the world, but I haven't looked carefully enough to be able to tell you what the UK or French or German or South Korean effort is.
But you'd certainly recommend it to us.
Absolutely.
Susan Landau, whose argument for resilience, i.e. creating workarounds to blunt the effect of ransomware attacks, sounds pretty compelling. My thanks to her, to Emily Taylor, Sadie Kreese and Jeff White. We're taking a short break and we'll be back with a new series at the beginning of July. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Sally Abrahams and Imogen Sawatka. The sound was mixed by James Beard and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. We've recently asked what Hamas wants, we've looked at what's happening in Hong Kong, and we've been briefed on how fragile the peace process is in Northern Ireland.
Charlie, I have been so excited to speak to you.
Hello, Myrna.
Hello, how are you, Joe?
I'm Joe Wicks, and I'm back for the second series of my podcast that's all about sharing ways to help you live a happier and healthier life. Doing a bit of research, and apparently you're into something called inversion therapy, where you hang upside down. What's
yes.
that, like a bat?
Exactly. I do it every day. You know, it all just sort of...
clears your head a little bit.
Yeah.
I get to speak to some heroes of mine, from the legend that is Sir Tom Jones, who I'm literally obsessed with, to one of our most successful UK athletes, Sir Mo Farah.
You have to be smart and control the race in the way that you want it.
It just settles me, it organises my brain.
Meditation, I think, is the cultivation of a space within you that if you don't turn to it, life will get in the way.
Subscribe now on BBC Sound so you never miss an episode. And you can also check out every single episode in video format on BBC iPlayer. The Joe Wicks podcast for BBC Radio 4.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.